that was ugly. Nino was what he wouldn't have wanted to be, and yet always had been. When he rhythmically hammered against Silvana's buttocks and was also kindly taking care to give her pleasure, he wasn't lying, just as he wasn't lying when he wronged me and was sorry, apologized, begged me to forgive him, swore that he loved me. "He is like that," I said to myself. But that didn't console me. I felt, rather, that the horror, instead of fading, found a more solid refuge in that statement. Then a warm liquid spread down to my knees. I shook myself. Ima was naked. She had peed on me. 76. Going home seemed unthinkable, even though it was cold and Ima risked getting sick. I wrapped her in my coat, as if we were playing. I bought a new package of diapers. I put one on after cleaning her with a baby wipe. Now, I had to decide what to do. Dede and Elsa would get out of school soon, irritable and hungry. Ima was already hungry. I, my jeans wet, without a coat, nerves tense, was shivering with cold. I looked for a telephone. I called Leela. I asked, "Can I come to lunch at your house with the children?" "Of course. Enzo won't be annoyed. You know he'll be pleased." I heard Tina's happy little voice. Leela said to her, "Quiet." Then she asked me with a wariness that she normally didn't have, "Is something wrong?"
"Yes."
"What happened?"
"What you predicted."
"Did you fight with Nino?"
"I'll tell you later. I have to go now."
I arrived early at school. Ima had by now lost any interest in me, the steering wheel, the horn, and was howling. I forced her yet again to stay wrapped in the jacket, and we went to find some cookies. I thought I was acting calmly. Inside, I felt tranquil. Not fury, but disgust still prevailed. A revulsion not different from what I would have felt if I had seen two lizards coupling. But I realized that the passers-by were looking at me with curiosity, with alarm, as I hurried along the street in my wet pants, talking aloud to the baby, who, squeezed tight in the coat, was wriggling and wailing. At the first cookie, Ima quieted down, but her calm freed my anxiety. Nino must have put off his appointment. He was probably looking for me. I was in danger of finding him at school. Since Elsa came out before Dede, who was in her second year of middle school, I went and stood in a corner from which I could watch the entrance of the elementary school without being seen. My teeth were chattering with cold. Ima was smearing my coat with saliva-soaked cookie crumbs. I surveyed the area, nervously, but Nino didn't appear. And he didn't appear at the entrance of the middle school, from which Dede soon emerged in a flood of pushing and shoving, shouts and insults in dialect. The children paid little attention to me. They were very interested in the novelty of my coming to get them with Ima.
"Why are you holding her in the coat?"
Dede asked.
"Because she's cold."
"Did you see she's ruining it?"
"It doesn't matter."
"Once, when I got you dirty, you slapped me,"
Elsa complained.
"It's not true."
"It's very true."
Dede investigated.
"Why is it that she has only a shirt and diaper on?"
"She's fine like that."
"Did something happen?"
"No. Now we're going to have lunch at Aunt Lena's."
They greeted the news with their usual enthusiasm. Then they settled in the car. And while the baby talked to her sisters in her obscure language, happy to be the center of their attention, they began to fight over who got to hold her. I insisted that they hold her together, without pulling her this way and that. "She's not made of rubber,"
I cried. Elsa wasn't pleased with that solution and swore at Dede in dialect. I tried to slap her. I said, staring at her in the rearview mirror, "What did you say? Repeat it. What did you say?" She didn't cry. She abandoned Ima to Dede, muttering that taking care of her sister bored her. Then, when the baby reached out her hands to play, she pushed her away roughly. She shouted, assaulting my nerves, "Ima, that's enough. You're bothering me. You're getting me dirty." And to me, "Mama, make her stop." I couldn't bear it anymore. I let out a scream that frightened all three of them. We crossed the city in a state of tension, broken only by the whispering of Dede and Elsa, who were trying to understand if, again, something irreparable was about to happen in their lives. I couldn't even tolerate that consultation. I couldn't bear anything anymore. Their childhood, my role as mother, Ima's babbling. And then the presence of my daughters in the car clashed with the images of coitus that were constantly before me, with the odor of sex that was still in my nostrils, with the rage that was beginning to advance, along with the most vulgar dialect. Nino had fucked the servant and then gone to his appointment, not giving a shit about me or even about his daughter. Ugh, what a piece of shit. All I did was make mistakes. Was he like his father? No, too simple. Nino was very intelligent. Nino was extraordinarily cultured. His propensity for fucking did not come from a crude, naive display of virility, based on half-fascistic, half-Southern cliches. What he had done to me, what he was doing to me, was filtered by a very refined knowledge. He dealt in complex concepts. He knew that this way he would offend me to the point of destroying me. But he had done it just the same. He had thought, "I can't give up my pleasure just because that shit can be a pain in the ass." Like that. Just like that. And surely he judged as Philistine, that adjective was still very widespread in our world, my possible reaction. Philistine. Philistine. I even knew the line he would resort to in sophisticated justification. "What's the harm? The flesh is weak, and I've read all the books." Exactly those words. Nasty son of a bitch. Rage had opened up a pathway in the horror. I shouted at Ima, even at Ima, to be quiet. When I reached Leela's house, I hated Nino as until that moment I had never hated anyone. 77. Leela had made lunch. She knew that Dede and Elsa adored orecchiette with tomato sauce, and she announced this, creating a rowdy scene of enthusiasm. That wasn't all. She took Ima from my arms and cared for her and Tina, as if suddenly her daughter had doubled. She changed them both, washed them, dressed them identically, cuddled them with an extraordinary display of maternal care. Then, since the two little girls had recognized each other at once and were playing, she put them down on an old carpet to crawl around, babble. How different they were. Bitterly, I compared the daughter of Nino and me to the daughter of Leela and Enzo. Tina seemed prettier, healthier than Ima. She was the sweet fruit of a solid relationship. Meanwhile, Enzo came home from work, cordially laconic as usual. At the table, neither he nor Leela asked me why I wasn't eating. Only Dede intervened, as if to take me away from her own bad thoughts and those of the others. She said, "My mama always eats just a little because she doesn't want to get fat, and I'm doing that too." I exclaimed, threatening. You have to clean your plate down to the last bite. And Enzo, perhaps to protect my daughters from me, started a comical contest to see who could eat the most and finish first. He patiently answered Dede's many questions about Reno. My daughter had hoped to see him at least for lunch, and explained that he had started a job in a workshop and was out all day. Then, at the end of the meal, in great secrecy, he took the two sisters into Donato's room to show them all the treasures there. After a few minutes, there was a burst of furious music, and they didn't come back. I was alone with Leela, and I told her every detail, in a tone between sarcasm and suffering. She listened without interrupting. I realized the more I put into words what had happened, the more ridiculous the scene of sex between that fat woman and skinny Nino seemed. He woke up. At a certain point, the words emerged in dialect. He found Silvana in the bathroom, and even before peeing, he pulled up her skirt and stuck it in. Then I burst out laughing in a vulgar fashion, and Leela looked at me uneasily. She used such tones she didn't expect them from me. You have to calm down, she said. And since Ima was crying, we went into the other room. My daughter, fair-haired, red in the face, was shedding large tears, her mouth open. And as soon as she saw me, she raised her arms to be picked up. Tina, dark, pale, stared at her, disconcerted. And when her mother appeared, she didn't move. She called to her as if she wanted her to help her understand, saying, Mama, clearly. Leela picked up both babies, settled one on each arm, kissed mine, drying her tears with her lips, spoke to her, soothed her. I was amazed. I thought, Tina says Mama clearly. All the syllables. Ima doesn't do that yet, and is almost a month older. I felt at a loss and sad. 1981 was about to end. I would get rid of Silvana. I didn't know what to write. The months would fly by. I wouldn't deliver my book. I would lose ground as well as my reputation as a writer. I would remain without a future. Dependent on financial support from Pietro, alone with three daughters, without Nino. Nino lost. Nino over. The part of me that continued to love him appeared again, not as in Florence, but rather as the child in elementary school had loved him, seeing him coming out of school. In confusion, I searched for an excuse to forgive him. In spite of the humiliation, I couldn't bear to drive him out of my life. Where was he? Was it possible that he hadn't even tried to look for me? I put together Enzo, who had immediately taken care of the two children, and Leela, who had freed me of every task and had listened, leaving me all the space I wanted. I finally understood that they had known everything before I arrived in the neighborhood. I asked, did Nino call? Yes. What did he say? That it was foolish, that I should stay with you, that I should help you understand that today people live like this. Talk. And you? I slammed the telephone down on him. But he'll call again? Of course he'll call again. I felt discouraged. Leela. I don't know how to live without him. It all lasted such a short time. I broke up my marriage. I came to live here with the children. I had another child. Why? Because you made a mistake. I didn't like the remark. It sounded like the echo of an old offense. She was reminding me that I had made a mistake, even though she had tried to get me out of the mistake. She was saying that I had wanted to make a mistake. And as a result, she had been mistaken. I wasn't intelligent. I was a stupid woman. I said, I have to talk to him. I have to confront him. All right, but leave me the children. You can't do it. There are four.
There are five. There's also Gennaro. And he's the most difficult of all.
You see? I'll take them.
Don't even mention it.
I admitted that I needed her help. I said, I'll leave them until tomorrow. I need time to resolve the situation.
Resolve it how?
I don't know. You want to continue with Nino? I could hear her opposition, and I almost shouted, what can I do?
The only thing possible. Leave him.
For her, it was the right solution. She had always wanted it to end like that. She had never concealed it from me. I said, I'll think about it.
No, you won't think about it. You've already decided to pretend it was nothing and go on.
I avoided answering, but she pressed me. She said that I shouldn't throw myself away, that I had another destiny, that if I went on like that, I would lose myself.
I noticed that she was becoming harsh. I felt that to restrain me, she was on the point of telling me what, for a long time, I had wanted to know, and what, for a long time, she had been silent about.
I was afraid, but had I not myself, on various occasions, tried to urge her to be clear? And now, had I not come to her also, so that finally she would tell me everything?
If you have something to tell me, I said, speak.
And she made up her mind. She looked at me. I looked down. She said that Nino had often sought her out. She said that he had asked her to come back to him, both before he had become involved with me and after. She said that when they took my mother to the hospital, he had been particularly insistent. She said that while the doctors were examining my mother and they were waiting for the results in the waiting room, he had sworn to her that he was with me only to feel closer to her.
Look at me, she whispered. I know I mean to tell you these things, but he is much worse than I am. He has the worst kind of meanness, that of superficiality. 78.
I returned to Via Tasso, determined to cut off every relation with Nino. I found the house empty and in perfect order. I sat beside the French door that led to the balcony. Life in that apartment was over. In a couple of years, the reasons for my very presence in Naples had been consumed. I waited with growing anxiety for him to appear. Several hours passed. I fell asleep. I woke with a start when it was dark. The telephone was ringing. I hurried to answer, sure that it was Nino, but it was Antonio. He was calling from a cafe nearby. He asked if I could meet him. I said, come up. I heard his hesitation. Then he agreed. I had no doubt that Leela had sent him, and he admitted it himself right away. She doesn't want you to do something foolish, he said, making an effort to speak in Italian. You can stop me?
Yes.
How? He sat down in the living room, after refusing the coffee I wanted to make for him, and deliberately, in the tone of someone who is used to giving detailed reports, listed all Nino's lovers, names, surnames, professions, relatives. Some I didn't know. They were relationships from long ago. Others he had brought to dinner at my house, and I remembered them, affectionate, with me and the children. Mirella, who had taken care of Dede, Elsa, and also Ima, had been with him for 3 years. And his relationship with the gynecologist who had delivered my daughter, and Leela's too, was even longer. Antonio enumerated a sizable number of females, he used that word, with whom, at various times, Nino had applied the same scheme. An intense period of meetings, then occasional encounters, in no case a definitive break. "He's faithful," Antonio said sarcastically. "He never really cuts off relations. Now he goes to that one, now he goes to that other."
"Does Leela know?"
"Yes."
"Since when?"
"Recently."
"Why didn't you tell me right away?"
"I wanted to tell you right away."
"And Leela?"
"She said to wait."
"And you obeyed her? You two let me cook and set the table for people he had betrayed me with the day before, or would betray me with the day after. I ate with people whose foot or knee or something else he touched under the table. I entrusted my children to a girl he jumped on as soon as I looked away."
Antonio shrugged. He looked at his hands, clasped them, and left them between his knees.
"If they tell me to do a thing, I do it," he said in dialect.
But then he got confused.
"I almost always do it," he said, and tried to explain. "Sometimes I obey money, sometimes respect, in some cases myself. As for infidelities," he said, "if you don't find out about them at the right moment, they're of no use. When you're in love, you forgive everything. For infidelities to have their real impact, some lovelessness has to develop first."
And he went on like that, piling up painful remarks about the blindness of people in love. As if by way of example, he told me again about how, years before, he had spied on Nino and Leela for the saladas. "In that case," he said proudly, "I didn't do what they ordered." He hadn't felt like handing Leela over to Michele, and had called Enzo so that he could get her out of trouble. He spoke again of the beating he had given Nino.
"I did it," he muttered, "most of all because you loved him and not me. And then because if that piece of shit went back to Leela, she would have stayed faithful to him and would be ruined forever. You see," he concluded, "in that case, too, there was little to be gained by talking. Leela wouldn't have listened to me. Love not only doesn't have eyes, it doesn't have ears either." I asked him, stunned, "In all these years, you never told Leela that Nino was going back to her that night?"
"No."
"You should have."
"Why?"
"When my head says it's better to act in this way, I do it, and I don't think about it anymore. If you go back to it, you only make trouble."
How wise he had become. That was when I learned that the story of Nino and Leela would have lasted a little longer if Antonio hadn't cut it off with a beating. But I immediately discarded the hypothesis that they would have loved each other all their lives, and perhaps both he and she would have become utterly different people. To me, it seemed not only unlikely, but unbearable. Instead, I sighed with impatience. Antonio had decided for his own reasons to save Leela, and now Leela had sent him to save me. I looked at him. I said, with explicit sarcasm, something about his role as a protector of women. He should have showed up in Florence, I thought, when I was hanging in the balance, when I didn't know what to do, and made the decision for me with his gnarled hands, as years before he had decided for Leela. I asked him teasingly, "What orders do you have now?"
"Before sending me here, Leela forbade me to break the face of that shit, but I did it once,
and I'd like to do it again.
You're unreliable.
Yes and no.
Meaning?
It's a complicated situation, Lenu. Stay out of it. You just tell me that the son of Saratore should repent the day he was born, and I'll make him repent.
I couldn't contain myself. I burst out laughing at the mannered seriousness with which he expressed himself. It was the tone he had learned in the neighborhood as a boy. The formal tone of the upright male, he who in reality had been timid and fearful. What an effort it must have been. But now it was his tone. He wouldn't have known how to have any other. The only difference, in relation to the past, was that in that situation he was making an effort to speak in Italian, and the difficult language was coming to him with a foreign accent. He darkened because of my laughter. He looked at the black panes of the window. He said, "Don't laugh." I saw that his forehead was shiny in spite of the cold. He was sweating from the shame of having seemed ridiculous to me. He said, "I know I don't express myself well. I know German better than Italian." I became aware of his odor, the way it had smelled at the time of the ponds. "I'm laughing," I apologized, "at the situation, at you, who wanted to kill Nino forever, and at me, who, if he showed up now, would say to you, 'Yes, kill him.' I'm laughing out of despair, because I've never been so offended, because I feel humiliated in a way that I don't know if you can imagine. Because, at this moment, I'm so ill that I think I'm fainting. In fact, I felt weak and dead inside. So I was suddenly grateful to Lila for having had the sensitivity to send me Antonio. He was the only person whose affection at that moment I didn't doubt. Besides, his lean body, his big bones, his thick eyebrows, his coarse features had remained familiar to me. They didn't repel me. I wasn't afraid of them. "At the ponds," I said. "It was cold, and we didn't feel it. I'm trembling. Can I sit next to you?" He looked at me uncertainly, but I didn't wait for his assent. I got up. I sat on his knees. He didn't move. He extended only his arms, for fear of touching me, and let them fall to the sides of the chair. I leaned against him, resting my face between his neck and his shoulder. It seemed to me that for a few seconds I fell asleep. "Lenu." "Yes?"
"Do you not feel well?"
"Hold me. I have to warm up."
"No."
"Why?"
"I'm not sure you want me."
"I want you now. This time only. It's something you owe me, and I owe you."
"I don't owe you anything. I love you, and you, instead, have always loved only him."
"Yes, but I never desired anyone the way I desired you. Not even him."
I talked for a long time. I told him the truth of that moment, and the truth of the faraway time of the ponds. He was the discovery of excitement. He was the pit of the stomach that grew warm, that opened up, that turned liquid, releasing a burning indolence. Franco, Pietro, Nino had stumbled on that expectation, but had never managed to satisfy it. Because it was an expectation without a definite object. It was the hope of pleasure, the hardest to fulfill. The taste of Antonio's mouth, the perfume of his desire, his hands, the large sex taut between his thighs constituted a before that couldn't be matched. The after had never been truly equal to our afternoons hidden by the skeleton of the canning factory. Although they consisted of love without penetration, and often without orgasm. I spoke in an Italian that was complex. I did it more to explain to myself what I was doing than to clarify to him. And this must have seemed to him an act of trust. He seemed content.
He held me. He kissed me on one shoulder, then on the neck, finally on the mouth.
I don't think I've had any other sexual relation like that, which abruptly joined the ponds of more than 20 years earlier and the room on Via Tasso, the chair, the floor, the bed, suddenly sweeping away everything that was between us, that divided us. What was me? What was him? Antonio was delicate. He was brutal. And I was the same, no less than him. He demanded things, and I demanded things with a fury, an anxiety, a need for violation that I didn't think I harbored. At the end, he was annihilated by wonder, and I was too.
What happened? I asked, stunned, as if the memory of that absolute intimacy had already vanished.
I don't know, he said, but luckily it happened.
I smiled. You're like everybody else. You've betrayed your wife.
I wanted to joke, but he took me seriously. He said in dialect, I haven't betrayed anyone. My wife, before now, doesn't exist yet.
An obscure formulation, but I understood. He was trying to tell me that he agreed with me. Seeking to communicate, in turn, a sense of time outside the present chronology. He wanted to say that we had lived now a small fragment of a day that belonged to 20 years earlier. I kissed him. I whispered, thank you. And I told him I was grateful, because he had chosen to ignore the brutal reasons for all that sex, mine and his, and to see in it only the need to close our accounts. Then the telephone rang. I went to answer. It might be Leela who needed me for the children. But it was Nino.
Luckily you're home, he said breathlessly. I'm coming right away.
No.
When?
Tomorrow.
Let me explain. It's essential. It's urgent.
No.
Why?
I told him, and hung up. 79.
It was hard to separate from Nino. It took months. I don't think I've ever suffered so much for a man. It tortured me both to keep him away and to take him back. He wouldn't admit that he had made romantic and sexual offers to Leela. He insulted her. He mocked her. He accused her of wanting to destroy our relationship, but he was lying. At first, he always lied. He even tried to convince me that what I had seen in the bathroom was a mistake due to weariness and jealousy. Then he began to give in. He confessed to some relationships, but backdated them. As for others, indisputably recent, he said they had been meaningless. He swore that with those women it was friendship, not love. We quarreled all through Christmas, all winter. Sometimes I silenced him, worn out by his skill at accusing himself, defending himself, and expecting forgiveness. Sometimes I yielded in the face of his despair, which seemed real. He often arrived drunk. Sometimes I threw him out because, out of honesty, pride, maybe even dignity. He never promised that he would stop seeing those he called his friends, nor would he assure me that he would not lengthen the list. On that theme, he often undertook long, very cultured monologues, in which he tried to convince me that it wasn't his fault, but that of nature, of astral matter, of spongy bodies and their excessive liquids, of the immoderate heat of his loins, in short, of his exorbitant virility. No matter how much I add up all the books I've read, he murmured, in a tone that was sincere, pained, and yet vain to the point of ridiculousness. No matter how much I add up the languages I've learned, the mathematics, the sciences, the literature, and most of all my love for you, yes, the love and the need I have for you, the terror of not being able to have you anymore. Believe me, I beg you, believe me, there's nothing to be done. I can't. The occasional desire, the most foolish, the most obtuse, prevails.
Sometimes he moved me. More often, he irritated me. In general, I responded with sarcasm. And he was silent. He nervously ruffled his hair. Then he started again. But when I said to him coldly one morning that perhaps all that need for women was the symptom of a labile heterosexuality that in order to endure needed constant confirmation, he was offended. He harassed me for days. He wanted to know if I had been better with Antonio than with him. Since I was now tired of all that distraught talk, I shouted, yes. And since, in that phase of excruciating quarrels, some of his friends had tried to get into my bed, and I, out of boredom, out of spite, had sometimes consented, I mentioned names of people he was fond of, and to wound him, I said they had been better than him. He disappeared. He had said that he couldn't do without Dede and Elsa. He had said that he loved Ima more than his other children. He had said that he would take care of the three children, even if I hadn't wanted to go back to him. In reality, not only did he forget about us immediately, but he stopped paying the rent in Via Tasso, along with the bills for the electricity, the gas, the telephone. I looked in vain for a cheaper apartment in the area. Often, apartments that were uglier and smaller commanded even higher rents. Then Lila said to me that there were three rooms and a kitchen available just above her. The rent was almost nothing. From the windows, you could see both the stradone and the courtyard. She said it in her way, in the tone of someone who signals, I'm only giving you the information. Do as you like. I was depressed. I was frightened. Elisa had recently yelled at me during a quarrel. Papa is alone. Go live with him. I'm tired of having to take care of him myself. And naturally, I had refused. In my situation, I couldn't take care of my father, too. I was already the slave of my daughters. Ima was constantly sick. As soon as Dede got over the flu, Elsa had it. She wouldn't do her homework unless I sat with her. Dede got mad and said, "Then you have to help me too." I was exhausted, a nervous wreck. And then, in the great chaos I had fallen into, I didn't have even that bit of active life that until then I had guaranteed myself. I turned down invitations and articles and trips. I didn't dare answer the telephone for fear it was the publisher asking for the book. I had ended up in a vortex that was pulling me down, and a hypothetical return to the neighborhood would be the proof that I had touched bottom. To immerse myself again and my daughters in that mentality, let myself be absorbed by Lila, by Carmen, by Alfonso, by everyone, just as, in fact, they wanted. No, I swore to myself that I would go and live in Tribunali, in Duquesca, in Lavinaio, in Forcella, amid the scaffolding that marked the earthquake damage, rather than return to the neighborhood. In that atmosphere, the editor called. How far along are you? It was an instant, a flame kindled in my head, illuminating it like day. I knew what I had to say and what I had to do. I finished just yesterday.
Seriously? Send it today. Tomorrow morning I'll go to the post office. Thank you. As soon as the book arrives, I'll read it and let you know.
Take your time.
I hung up. I went to a big box I kept in the bedroom closet. I pulled out the typescript that years before neither Adele nor Leela had liked. I didn't even attempt to reread it. The next morning, I took the children to school and went with Ima to send the package. I knew that it was a risky move, but it seemed to me the only one possible to save my reputation. I had promised to deliver a novel, and here it was. Was it an unsuccessful novel? Irrefutably bad? Well, it wouldn't be published. But I had worked hard. I hadn't deceived anyone. I would soon do better. The line at the post office was exhausting. I had to protest continually against people who didn't respect it. In that situation, my disaster became obvious to me. Why am I here? Why am I wasting time like this? The girls and Naples have eaten me alive. I don't study. I don't write. I've lost all discipline. I had gained a life very far from what might have been expected for me, and look how I had ended up. I felt exasperated, guilty toward myself, and especially toward my mother. Furthermore, Ima had been making me anxious. When I compared her with Tina, I was sure she was suffering from some developmental problem. Leela's daughter, although she was 3 weeks younger, was very lively, seemed more than a year old, whereas Ima seemed unresponsive and had a vacant look. I observed her obsessively. I harassed her with tests that I invented on the spot. I thought, it would be terrible if Nino not only had ruined my life, but had given me a daughter with problems. And yet people stopped me on the street because she was so plump, so fair. Here, even at the post office, the women in line complimented her. How chubby she was. But she didn't even smile. A man offered her a candy, and Ima stretched out her hand reluctantly, took it, dropped it. Ah, I was constantly anxious. Every day a new worry was added to the others. When I came out of the post office and the package had been sent and there was no way to stop it, I jumped. I remembered my mother-in-law. Good Lord, what had I done? Was it possible that I hadn't considered that the publisher would give the manuscript to Adele? It was she, after all, who had wanted the publication of both my first book and the second. They owed it to her, if only out of courtesy. And she would say, Greco is cheating you. This isn't a new text. I read it years ago, and it's terrible. I broke out in a cold sweat. I felt weak. To plug one leak, I had created another. I was no longer able to keep under control, even within the limits of the possible, the chain of my actions. 80. Just then, to complicate things, Nino showed up again. He had never given me back the keys, even though I had insisted on having them, and so he reappeared without calling, without knocking. I told him to go. The house was mine. He wasn't paying the rent and wasn't giving me a cent for Ima. He swore that, annihilated by grief at our separation, he had forgotten. He seemed sincere. He had a feverish look and was very thin. He promised with an involuntarily comical solemnity to start paying the next month. He spoke in a sorrowful voice of his love for Ima. Then, apparently in a good-humored way, he began to ask again about my encounter with Antonio, about how it had gone, first in general and then sexually. From Antonio, he moved on to his friends. He tried to make me admit that I had yielded. Yield seemed to him the right verb. to this one or that one, not out of genuine attraction, but only out of spite. I was alarmed when he began to caress my shoulder, my knee, my cheek. I soon saw, in his eyes and in his words, that what made him desperate was not that he had lost my love, but that I had been with those other men, and that sooner or later I would be with others and would prefer them to him. He had showed up that morning only to re-enter my bed. He demanded that I vilify those recent lovers by showing him that my only desire was to be penetrated again by him. He wanted, in other words, to reassert his primacy. Then surely he would again disappear. I managed to get the keys back, and I threw him out. I realized then, and to my surprise, that I no longer felt anything for him. The long time that I had loved him dissolved conclusively that morning. The next day, I began to ask about what I had to do to get a job, even as a substitute in the middle schools. I quickly realized that it wouldn't be simple, and that, in any case, I would have to wait for the new school year. Since I took for granted the break with the publisher, which was followed in my imagination by the devastating collapse of my identity as a writer, I was frightened. From birth, the children had been used to a comfortable life. I myself, ever since my marriage to Pietro, couldn't imagine being without books, magazines, newspapers, records, movies, theater. I had to think immediately of some provisional job, and I put advertisements in the local shops offering private lessons. Then one morning in June, the editor called. He had received the manuscript. He had read it. "Already?" I said with feigned indifference. "Yes. And it's a book that I would never have expected from you, but that you, surprisingly, wrote."
"You're saying it's bad?"
"It is. From the first line to the last, pure pleasure of narration."
My heart was going crazy in my chest. "Is it good or not?"
"It's extraordinary."
81. I was proud. In a few seconds, I not only regained faith in myself, I relaxed. I began to speak of my work with a childish enthusiasm. I laughed too much. I questioned the editor closely to get a more articulated approval. I quickly understood that he had read my pages as a sort of autobiography, an arrangement in novel form of my experience of the poorest and most violent Naples. He said he had feared the negative effects of a return to my city, but now he had to admit that that return had helped me. I didn't say that the book had been written several years earlier in Florence.
"It's a harsh novel," he emphasized. "I would say masculine, but paradoxically, also delicate. In other words, a big step forward."
Then he discussed organizational questions. He wanted to move the publication to the spring of 1983 to devote himself to careful editing and to prepare the launch. He concluded, with some sarcasm,
"I talked about it with your ex-mother-in-law. She said that she had read an old version and hadn't liked it, but evidently, either her taste has aged or your personal problems kept her from giving a dispassionate evaluation."
I quickly admitted that long ago I had let Adele read a first draft. He said,
"It's clear that the air of Naples has given free rein to your talent."
When he hung up, I felt hugely relieved. I changed. I became particularly affectionate toward my daughters. The publisher paid the rest of the advance, and my economic situation improved. Suddenly, I began to look at the city, and especially at the neighborhood, as an important part of my life. Not only should I not dismiss it,
but it was essential to the success of my work. It was a sudden leap, going from distrust to a joyful sense of myself. What I had felt as a precipice not only acquired literary nobility, but seemed to me a determined choice of a cultural and political arena. The editor himself had sanctioned it authoritatively, saying, "For you, returning to the point of departure has been a step forward." Of course, I hadn't said that the book was written in Florence, that the return to Naples had had no influence on the text. But the narrative material, the human depth of the characters, came from the neighborhood, and surely the turning point was there. Adele hadn't had the sensitivity to understand, so she had lost. All the Airotas had lost. Nino had lost, too, as, in essence, he had considered me one of the women on his list, without distinguishing me from the others. And, what for me was even more significant, Lila had lost. She hadn't liked my book. She had been severe. It was one of the few times in her life she had cried, when she had had to wound me with her negative judgment. But I didn't want it from her. Rather, I was pleased that she was wrong. From childhood, I had given her too much importance, and now I felt as if unburdened. Finally, it was clear that what I was wasn't her, and vice versa. Her authority was no longer necessary to me. I had my own. I felt strong, no longer a victim of my origins, but capable of dominating them, of giving them a shape, of taking revenge on them for myself, for Lila, for whomever. What before was dragging me down was now the material for climbing higher. One morning, in July of 1982, I called her and said, "All right, I'll take the apartment above you. I'm coming back to the neighborhood." 82. I moved in midsummer. Antonio took care of the logistics. He assembled some brawny men who emptied the apartment on Via Tasso and arranged everything in the apartment in the neighborhood. The new house was dark, and repainting the rooms didn't help brighten it. But, contrary to what I had thought since I returned to Naples, this didn't bother me. In fact, the dusty light that had always struggled to penetrate the windows had the effect on me of an evocative childhood memory. Dede and Elsa, on the other hand, protested at length. They had grown up in Florence, Genoa, in the bright light of Via Tasso, and they immediately hated the floors of uneven tiles, the small dark bathroom, the din of the stradone. They resigned themselves only because now they could enjoy some not insignificant advantages. See Aunt Lena every day. Get up later because the school was nearby. Go there by themselves. Spend time on the street and in the courtyard. I was immediately seized by a yearning to regain possession of the neighborhood. I enrolled Elsa in the elementary school where I had gone, and Dede in my middle school. I resumed contact with anyone, old or young, who remembered me. I celebrated my decision with Carmen and her family, with Alfonso, with Ada, with Pinuccia. Naturally, I had misgivings, and Pietro, who was very unhappy with the decision, made them worse. He said on the telephone, "On the basis of what criteria do you want to bring up our daughters in a place that you fled?" "I won't bring them up here." "But you've taken a house and enrolled them in school without considering that they deserve something else."
"I have a book to finish, and I can only do it well here."
"I could have taken them."
"You would also take Ima?"
"All three are my daughters, and I don't want the third to be separated from the other two."
He calmed down. He was happy that I had left Nino, and he soon forgave the move.
"Keep at your work. he said. I have confidence in you. You know what you're doing.
I hoped it was true.
I watched the trucks that passed noisily along the stradone, raising dust. I walked in the gardens that were full of syringes. I went into the neglected, empty church. I felt sad in front of the parish cinema, which had closed, in front of the party offices, which were like abandoned dens. I listened to the shouting of men, women, children in the apartments, especially at night. The feuds between families, the hostilities between neighbors, the ease with which things came to blows, the wars between gangs of boys. When I went to the pharmacy, I remembered Gino. I felt revulsion at the sight of the place where he had been killed and went cautiously around it. I spoke compassionately to his parents, who were still behind the old dark wood counter, more bent over, white-haired in their white smocks, and as kind as ever. As a child, I endured all this, I thought. Let's see if now I can control it. How is it that you decided to do it? Leela asked some time after the move. Maybe she wanted an affectionate answer, or maybe a sort of recognition of the validity of her choices. Words like, you were right to stay. Going out into the world was of no use. Now I understand. Instead, I answered, it's an experiment.
Experiment in what?
We were in her office. Tina was near her. Ima was wandering on her own. I said, an experiment in recomposition. You've managed to have your whole life here, but not me. I feel I'm in pieces scattered all over. She had an expression of disapproval.
Forget these experiments, Lainu. Otherwise you'll be disappointed and leave again. I'm also in pieces. Between my father's shoe repair shop and this office, it's only a few meters. But it's as if they were at the North Pole and the South Pole.
I said, pretending to be amused. Don't discourage me. In my job, I have to paste one fact to another with words. And in the end, everything has to seem coherent, even if it's not.
But if the coherence isn't there, why pretend?
To create order. Remember the novel I gave you to read and you didn't like? There, I tried to set what I know about Naples within what I later learned in Pisa, Florence, Milan. Now, I've given it to the publisher, and he thought it was good.
It's being published.
She narrowed her eyes. She said softly,
I told you that I don't understand anything.
I felt I had wounded her. It was as if I had thrown it in her face. If you can't connect your story of the shoes with the story of the computers, that doesn't mean that it can't be done. It means only that you don't have the tools to do it. I said hastily, you'll see, no one will buy the book and you'll be right. Then I listed somewhat randomly all the defects that I myself attributed to my text and what I wanted to keep or change before it was published. But she escaped. It was as if she wanted to regain altitude. She started talking about computers, and she did it as if to point out,
you have your things, I mine.
She said to the children, do you want to see a new machine that Enzo bought? She led us into a small room. She explained to Dede and Elsa,
this machine is called a personal computer. It costs a lot of money, but it can do wonderful things. Look how it works.
She sat on a stool, and first she settled Tina on her knees. Then she began patiently to explain every element, speaking to Dede, to Elsa, to the baby, never to me. I looked at Tina the whole time. She talked to her mother, asked, pointing, what's this? And if her mother didn't pay attention, she tugged on the edge of her shirt, grabbed her chin, insisted,
Mama, what's this?
Leela explained it to her as if she were an adult. Ima wandered around the room.